Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Substantial assistance. Substantial assistance is the phrase that paid with the filing produced by Special Counsel Bob Mueller yesterday recommending no prison time for retired General Michael Flynn, Trump's very brief national security advisor. 19 interviews since the outset of Mueller's engagement with one Flynn and his ultimately his agree to plead out to lying to the lying to the right. FBI, effectively.
Well, did you read it? I mean, it was so heavily redacted. That as soon
not
as
much
it got,
to read.
There was nothing to read. As soon as it got good, then there is it was blacked out. So, I don't. I mean, I wonder because it did say in there a criminal, for a criminal, that he might have had something criminal, and I don't know what exactly that means.
Yeah, I'm not sure anybody does. The
rest of the sentence was redacted, but he's not spending any time in jail, so that's good.
His early cooperation gave prosecutors a roadmap for the Russia investigation and may have helped to encourage others to cooperate. Oh, yeah? Well, we're 18 months in, and I know prosecutors like to pad the stats, and the D.C. press corps focuses on 33. That's the number of people who have been charged with crime since the probe began. Well, you got to back that number out a little bit. That includes 13 Russian nationals and 12 Russian intelligence officers. Oh, yeah. So, I mean, you might, if you want to pat this out, you can indict the entire Putin government if you want. I mean, what's the difference? Obviously, the focus and the only import here is whether or not President Trump and other associates, campaign operatives, engaged in some sort of illegal conspiracy with foreign agents. And that's where Mueller's probe still seems to be without foundation. And that's the problem.
Well, it said, too, that he helped with three other investigations. What three other investigations? Do you think Manafort? I mean, what other? I don't know. That's the problem.
I mean, this is all, you know, divining, tea leaf reading. The reporting has been focused on WikiLeaks and emails, the Trump Tower meeting, and this tower in Moscow that wasn't built. And so what do you really have? You have Michael Cohen. You have Manafort, you have Gates, you have Papadopoulos, and you have Flynn. And
Roger Stone.
Who are, well, you don't have Roger Stone charged with anything.
No.
Yeah, so you
he pled the fifth yesterday in front of the, he was not going to answer questions from the Senate.
So those are five people who've pled out to lying to the FBI and, in the case of Gates and Manafort, business activity unrelated to the 2016 campaign. So what do you have? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line. You got five people who've pled out to lying to the FBI, and this is the Dershowitz point. Mm-hmm. They've pled out, with the exception of Manafort and Gates because of their previous business activity, but still, would it have come under the scrutiny of federal prosecutors had Manafort not been involved in the 2016 campaign? And Dershowitz's larger point with respect to pleading guilty to lying to the FBI is the special counsel's office is creating crimes that heretofore weren't committed, that were not committed before they started investigating and putting pressure on people. Now, that doesn't excuse lying to the FBI, and everybody's an adult here, and you know going in that lying to the FBI is a crime.
Don't do it.
So I'm not excusing it. But in terms of the forest, not the twigs, the forest is criminal conspiracy of some sort. And what evidence do we have of that? This was the point that Stephen F. Cohen, who's a celebrated Russian studies professor, 50 years, Princeton, NYU, he was on with Tucker, and he made two points. One is that this Russiagate investigation, sans any evidence, actually hurts our national security. And how does it hurt our national security? Because, for example, at the recently concluded G20 summit, for political reasons, Trump can't talk to Putin, his aggression in Ukraine, when this is precisely the time that America should engage with Russia to stave off armed conflict, Stephen Cohen.
Because of these Russiagate allegations, clearly, that you've just discussed with Professor Dershowitz, that Trump feels not free to deal with Putin in terms of national security. Think back to John Kennedy during the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962. I mean, that was the model of what we should never do again. But the lesson also was is that President Kennedy was free to negotiate with the Kremlin leader to avoid nuclear war. That is not the case today. And that's why I think the danger of war with Russia, at least since the Cuban Missile Crisis, is greater in my lifetime, in history, than it's ever been, because of these Russiagate allegations, for which I've yet to see any authentic evidence. And we saw that last week. Trump either felt he could not or he lacked the resolve to go ahead and meet with Putin, even though this meeting is desperately needed. There's a new crisis every month with Russia.
And again, Cohen, a longtime card-carrying member of the leftist intelligentsia, and he goes on to further put Democrats on the dime as it pertains to fanning the flames of these Russiagate allegations.
Russiagate allegations that Trump is somehow under the influence of the Kremlin. There's no evidence for it. So in my mind, whoever promotes this Russiagate allegations, and it's primarily Democrats, not only, but primarily the Democratic Party, is endangering our national security. Now, that's not a popular thing for a person such as myself, who used to live on the liberal reservation, to say. And people denounce me for saying it. But it's the real truth based on my 50 years of studying American-Russian relations. We're in a very dangerous situation, Tucker, and this has to stop, and has to stop very soon.
It's interesting, and it's also interesting that Stephen F. Cohen, the celebrated academic, only gets amplification of his views these days on Tucker Carlson's show. Yeah, the Nation and the left not so interested in what he has to say anymore, but he's essentially saying people like Adam Schiff, Jared Nadler, they're the ones endangering national security, not President Trump. Sans any evidence to the contrary, and at some point, and perhaps in the not-too-distant future, Mueller is going to have to prove up on all of these topics and all of these investigations that we try to interpret from morsels of information parceled out over 18 months. It's absurd. Bruno in Naperville.
Yeah, from Trump's campaign, rhetoric and all that, I'm pretty sure that his intention was to do a sort of Nixon in reverse to, improve relations with the Russians, because we really can't afford to have Russia and China aligned against us. And his intention, I'm pretty sure, was to improve relations with Russia and to pivot towards China to protect our interests in the Far East. And it has made it impossible, this whole narrative. Plus, this equation of the Russia today with the Soviet Union of the 40s, 50s, and 60s, and, through the 80s is completely inaccurate. There's no comparison. The Russia of today is not this communist monolith trying to spread communism around the world. It's militarily and economically weak compared to what it used to be. It's nominally Christian. It's just not the same thing.
Well, yeah. Well, thanks for the cover. I mean, I agree it's not the same thing. However, and this is sort of an important point for establishment Republicans to remember. Remember when Mitt Romney said that Russia was the greatest foreign threat facing the United States, and he was ridiculed. And now that seems to be the Democrats' position.
Ridiculed live on camera by President Obama.
Yeah.
And now who looks like the fool?
So, if Mitt Romney was onto something, then President Trump is onto something and Stephen Cohen is onto something. Jim in Crown Point, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
You know, the investigation, the Democrats thought they had it by stacking the deck. These are all guys that are interrelated, and they thought that this would be a slam dunk. But the one thing that Trump has that he should never give up is his Twitter. He is able to say what he thinks and let people hear what he has to say, and he's actually turned the tide with Twitter. This Mueller guy is like a compulsive gambler. He thinks, if I just another hour, I'll be able to get this, you know, get ahead.
Yeah.
It's not going to end. Trump better clean house when this is all over.
Thanks for the call, Jim. I mean, and again, Andy McCarthy's argument, Mueller isn't putting together a prosecution. He's putting together a report to justify the last 18 months and $18 million spent. Ed in Oak Brook.
You know what? Mueller really doesn't have to do anything. He could probably drag this on as long as Trump is in office. And basically all this is doing is dissuading people from participating with Trump. I'm talking about people that actually have skills, you know, skills as far as business savvy and so forth. And it's so, for a guy like me out on the street, it's so frustrating because Clinton everyone, all the liberals complain that you guys always bring up Clinton. But Clinton got a pass on everything, and so did Michelle Obama with that Obamacare, with that computer system. And they're out there like they're on the high road. It's so frustrating to see that you have no idea, and that's what Mueller's doing. He's just dividing this country even more.
Thanks.
Have a nice day.
Thanks for the call, Ed. Well, I mean, and just again, to put some emphasis on what Professor Cohen had to say, it's not just frustrating. It turns out that it could be very dangerous.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Has this song been banned, or are we allowed to play this song?
Oh, yeah, later on we'll...
I know Baby's Cold Outside is out.
Well, yeah, we talked about that yesterday or 2 days ago, but we have a new song that they banned, which we'll tell you about later.
Sure.
'Tis the season for giving, and that's what we're doing here at AM 560, making someone's holiday a little bit brighter. We're asking for a one-time donation for $80. With that, you'll provide food for a year and water for life for one child or adult in Haiti. The number to call is 844-862-HOPE. That's 844-862-4673, or go to 560theanswer.com/food. I made a donation yesterday, and I sounded as bad as I sound right now. And the lady said, ma'am, can you speak up, please?
I didn't.
I just called that phone number and made an $80 donation and made somebody's Christmas a little merrier.
What about the business benefactor program, Moneybags?
Moneybags here doesn't have a business, but you do, Mr. Moneybags.
Yeah. I'm noticing on our list a lot of attorneys doing some penance for the holidays, which is good. So you should follow the example of Spiegel and Cahill, Matthew Hickey, attorney at law in Chicago, and, you know, do a little make good for the practicing law, particularly if you're in Cook County or the Metro East in Illinois.
Signature Bank, Twin Supplies Company of Oak Brook. The list goes on and on. And you want to be like one of the cool kids.
Well, yeah.
You want to get on this list because it's the best deal in radio.
No, the entrepreneurs is a different story. They're value adds.
Oh.
The lawyers? I mean, really.
What?
If I were you and I'm thinking about the... the hereafter, I think about making a $2,500 business benefactor donation. I mean, if I'm an attorney.
Right.
I think the business benefactor program is the way you want to go to get onto that stairway to heaven. And the way you do that is call our sales manager, Ann Jeanette, 847-472-8951.
Bingo.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, call Ann Jeanette. She's waiting for your phone call, 847-472-8951. If you have any questions, she will answer them. But it's really the best deal in Chicagoland radio. $2,500 tax-deductible donation, and we give you 40 60-second commercials.
And I only shame, you know.
Yeah, why are you?
I only shame attorneys because, you know, they deserve it.
Oh, my gosh.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy, and every president gets these 3 days, and today December 5th, a national day of mourning for President George Herbert Walker Bush. Bush 41, lying in state. You know, the couple of touching moments this week already. More to come today, I'm sure.
Yeah.
One, the dog.
Oh, my gosh. I cannot stop looking at Sully. Now, Sully came to H.W. Bush after Babs died in June. Excuse me, Barbara. I don't know why I call her Babs. And there's pictures of them. They take walks together. You know, he's in his wheelchair. The dog is leading him on his daily walk. The dog's with him everywhere. And when President Clinton came to visit, the dog was there. The dog was there.
Sure, guard dog.
Yeah, with him when he passed in his room. And yesterday, he was sitting at attention. I'm crying even thinking about it. By his owner. And just, it's a man and his dog, you know. And it's just beautiful. And the dog's going to go back to Walter Reed Hospital and be with other dogs. But I think he should stay with somebody in the family. I don't want him to go away from the Bushes. He took Air Force One with his owner's casket. I mean, this dog's everything to him.
And bad. So there's the dog, and then there's the Dole.
I see what you did there.
Yeah. Bob Dole, haven't seen that video, you got to watch that video. Bob Dole getting marshaling to his feet, 95-year-old Bob Dole, marshaling to his feet to salute the casket of George Herbert Walker Bush.
It's very touching.
Yeah. I mean, thinking about two World War II heroes and then, you know, their impact on politics, their political careers, uneven, certainly open to a lot of critique, at least from a conservative perspective, as Newt Gingrich famously called Bob Dole the tax collector for the welfare state.
Mm-hmm.
And we've talked at length already about George Herbert Walker Bush and his domestic policy choices, including breaking his no new taxes pledge. But just in terms of that kind of personal level between the two men, two patriots, two war heroes. There's a good piece by Quinn Hillier in Washington Examiner, you know, kind of the backstory, like remembering the relationship. You got to think about it a little bit. They were rivals for most of their careers. They weren't friends.
No, they weren't.
But then when George H.W. Bush beat Bob Dole in the primary in 88 and ascended to the presidency, as Hillier recalls in his piece, Dole, the Republican Senate leader, worked unceasingly to promote Bush's agenda. No senator could possibly have been more loyal and perhaps none so effective in that political climate. For his part, Bush, saying Dole had inspired him, helped Dole pass a cause dear to his heart, which is the Americans with Disabilities Act. You know, can argue about the regulatory nature of it, but it's more more focused on the relationship between the two and how it evolved. Bob Dole said at a 2016 commemoration of Pearl Harbor's 75th anniversary, talking about Bush, "This is a case where two political enemies became fast friends, and that's the way it's supposed to be." Dole supporting Jeb for president in 2016, you'll recall.
Yep, I remember. I remember seeing him and saying hi to him at the RNC. In Cleveland, he was in the back, and I just went over there and said hello. And he's getting up there in age, too. But the fact that he used help yesterday to stand up and salute as best he could, his formal rival, later friend, meant a lot to this country.
And it's interesting, as much as the press wants to, I don't know, use this occasion, it really cheapens the legacy and the life of George H.W. Bush to use his passing as a way to take shots at Trump. I mean, you know.
Well, they're saying they're comparing the men and how, the way well, that
I know
their president.
They're
I mean, they present differently, obviously. But
I know what they're
social
doing.
Media wasn't even around when H.W. Bush was president. I mean, the country's changed. Society's changed.
Well, I know. And the point is we're recalling and remarking upon the life and times of H.W. Bush. He doesn't need to be compared to every other president. I mean, right. In terms of, you know, standing maybe, in terms of accomplishment. But this is just sort of cheap theatrics by the D.C. press corps to pull in Trump. And interestingly,
the Trumps have been very gracious to the Bushes.
And vice versa. H.W. Bush made it clear to not make a spectacle of the disagreement and the chilliness between the two families by obviously making sure that he was in attendance at the funeral.
Yep.
Can parent contrast that to how McCain chose to handle it?
Oh my gosh, McCain. I mean, who comes out with a wish list of who they don't want at their funeral? You talk about bitter. I mean, my goodness. But yesterday, Melania invited Laura Bush and 20 of her friends to go, you know, see, have a tour of the White House again, and old staff members came and they took pictures together, and I thought that was very gracious of the Trumps to do that. They're going to be in attendance today at the funeral, and George W. Bush, former president, is going to be delivering the eulogy. And his daughters were interviewed on the Today Show because his daughter works there. But the twins were interviewed, and they said, Dad is just worried about trying not to cry.
Well,
and that he doesn't want to, you know, break down into tears during his eulogy.
I mean, do you think about this, too, as the passing of the World War II generation?
Yeah.
I mean, again, the last president who served in World War II, Herbert Walker Bush, Bush 41, last president with, you know, I don't want to say real military service, because, of course, Bush 43 was in the National Guard, but, I mean...
Well, combat experience.
Yes. And also, I mean, it's remarkable, too, to think about. I mean, Bush and Dole could have easily never come home.
Easily. I mean, everybody else on his plane and Bush's plane died.
And think about then the last 60 years of both of their lives and the impact. Again, I would, on the merits, uneven. But there is something that's sort of transcendental. Certainly that moment yesterday with Dole rising from his wheelchair to salute H.W. Bush. There's something transcendental about that moment that speaks to more than a disagreement about a particular policy or a particular vote or a particular election cycle. I mean, that is a moment that should be indelible, that younger generations need to have that, I think, explained to them how important and powerful that moment was, because that is a moment that shouldn't be lost.
And one thing, I just wanted to get this in here. We know we talked about James Baker. He was in the room with him. But this is what he said to H.W. when he saw him.
One of the aides who assisted him physically said, Mr. President, Secretary Baker's here. And he opened both eyes. He looked at me. He said, hey, Bake, where are we going today? And I said, well, Heffy, I said, we're going to heaven. He said, good. That's where I want to go. Little did I know, or did he know, of course, that by 10 o'clock that night, he'd be in heaven.
Greg and Schomburg, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Everything you said just about the World War II generation, since my dad was there, and I just want to emphasize the role of the mom, too, especially Barbara Bush. When you look at that family, that was a team. And most of the parents that we had from that generation were a team. You never saw division among them. They worked as a team they worked in a way that just doesn't exist anymore. And it's just so admirable.
Thanks for the call, Greg. And again, mentioned this yesterday, but we could play some of these important clips.
Oh, yeah.
Bush 41, that Larry King interview in 1999. Talking about sort of what Greg was getting to, the dynastic nature of the Bush family and the history of American politics, something that Bush 41 wasn't comfortable with.
Do you ever think, before we talk about the book, that your family, like the Adamses, Kennedys, and Roosevelts, have become an American political dynasty?
Well, we don't like the word dynasty.
What would
but
you call
it? I tell you what we do, that now that I'm out of politics and... And literally, I mean, I don't go to Washington, I don't testify, I don't write op-ed pieces. I had my chance, it's my son's chance. And what Barbara and I do is just take pride. You show me a picture of your kid. I take the same pride in George and Jeb as I did when they could hit a triple in Little League. And they're governors of two big states.
But you don't think about your father and the whole family was in politics like the Kennedys. I mean, when you think about it, the Adams, Kennedys, Roosevelts, and Bushes are four American political families.
Well, we haven't got that far along that we think about it in that legacy or dynasty terms. It's hard to differentiate. It's more.
Do you ever think about being first father?
Yeah, I do. With enormous pride in our son that's trying and respect for anybody that gets into this tough arena these days. Those on the other side. I mean,
You miss it?
I don't. I honestly, Larry, I don't. I had my chance, And I don't miss it.
Class act. Oh, and also you can hear, we are going to have the funeral live. If you're in your car, you can listen to it here at 10 a.m. on AM 560, The Answer.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So President Trump couldn't just leave the good news coming out of the G20 that there was going to be a temporary truce to the trade war between the United States and China. Couldn't just leave that alone. Couldn't just let Larry Kudlow do the talking. Larry Kudlow coming out of the G20 on Varney the other day saying this.
President Xi and Vice Premier Liu He has said to us their commitments will begin immediately, Stuart. Immediately. Okay. Now, I don't know that that point has been made. That doesn't mean we're going to cover everything in the first 3 days. However, when it comes to the agriculture, energy, industrial purchases, and so forth, these are private sector purchases where tariff rates will be lowered, and also non-tariff barriers will be lowered with respect to American ownership, for example, with respect to technology transfers, with respect to IP. Those things should kick in soon. We should see palpable changes on the Chinese side immediately.
We need palpable changes on the president's rhetoric on this side immediately. I'm not nearly as optimistic as Kudlow is about what China will do tangibly other than potentially lower some tariffs. But in terms of the non-tariff barriers, I don't buy that at all. However, Trump yesterday sparking a sell-off.
Yeah, because of a tweet. President Z and I want this deal to happen, and it probably will. But if not, remember, I am a tariff man. And then
when people or countries come in to raid the great wealth of our nation, I want them to pay for the privilege of doing so. Trade is raiding the great wealth of our nation. There's a fundamental misunderstanding of trade policy, which we knew. I mean, I'm not feigning surprise. He has been saying the same thing for three decades. So nobody should be surprised. But don't tell me he's saying something different than what he's saying. And this has been the conversation for the last 2 years with Steve Moore and other free market economists, or otherwise free market economists, with respect to Trump on trade. He has it wrong. He doesn't understand. And this tweet, we are right now taking in billions of dollars in tariffs. Make America rich again. So we're going to tax our way to prosperity. That is a fair translation of what that statement means. Yeah. Make America rich again, taking billions of tariffs. I am a tariff man. That's the president saying I am a tax man. What kind of market positioning is that? For more on this topic, we're pleased to be joined by John Tamney, who is the director of the Center for Economic Freedom, editor of RealClearMarkets.com, and the author of the book, The End of Work, Why Your Passion Can Become Your Job. Oh, I want to talk about that book, too. John, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, thank you so much for having me. And I want to stress, I couldn't agree more with the two of you and the way you've described this. We are talking, it's shameful what Republicans have done in the past couple of years. To suddenly run away from all that made them great in terms of free trade and allowing people, individuals, to trade the fruits of their labor with whomever they wanted. Suddenly they're all protectionists, defending a president who says, I want to raise more revenues for the federal government on the backs of American producers, and in doing so, empower the federal government to grow. The government doesn't take in dollars to look at them. That just gives it more control over our lives, more control over the economy, and Republicans have gone along with it. I find it very embarrassing. I've always voted Republican. I don't see how I could do it at this point.
Do you see this as an overture from President Trump to not only congressional Democrats, but back to his Rust Belt base in states that he needs in 2020. Is this is at least in part a political play, even though, again, to repeat, he's been saying things like this for three decades. So nobody should feel the need to have the scales fall from their eyes on this.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. There are some politics at play here, for sure. And the beauty of it, you guys, of course, alluded to it. There was a major stock sell-off, and it's a reminder that the most powerful force in the world, much more powerful than nuclear weapons or anything like that, is the stock market. Trump can only take this so far. At which point he destroys what he's made his presidency about. And one area in which I've cheered him on is he's been the one president to say, I want to be judged by the stock market. Wouldn't it be great if all presidents let market signals be the judge of their achievements? Because the least interventionist president would, in most instances, have the boomingest stock market. Okay, well, so if you liked it going up, you must acknowledge that your desire to limit the ability of Americans to exchange has had a very negative impact on the stock market, and for obvious reasons. Trump is going after the biggest market in the world for our best companies. Apple is the most valuable company in the world. It sells 20% of its iPhones in China. McDonald's, that's China's second largest market, soon to be its first. Nike, that's its second largest market. There are 3,400 Starbucks in China. There are soon to be 7,000. There are double the number of Starbucks in Shanghai than there are in New York City. GM sells a third more cars in China every year than it does in all of North America. The list goes on and on. Boeing sells a quarter of its planes in China. To go to war with China on trade is the equivalent of Gucci telling Manhattan and Beverly Hills, oh, we don't want to sell to you anymore. And so is it any wonder that stocks sell off when you are looking to limit the ability of U.S. companies to transact with what remains a small market even now, but will be the biggest market in the world in the future? It's already huge, but when the Chinese get rich, it's going to be a massive market for U.S. companies. And, wow. And we're trying to ruin that trade relationship.
Well, do you think President Trump's tweet, though, I mean, that there was a direct correlation between that and then the Dow plunging 799 points?
Well, I think there is a combination. I think isn't it interesting that every time the media come out and cheer Trump for basically blinking, for walking back the rhetoric as in, okay, there's a 90-day delay and the markets like it. And so if you notice the op-eds on Monday, and they were Trump blinked, Trump stepped back, he did the right thing. He hates to be seen as weak. And so what does he respond with? Well, the tweet, but also for what was front page news yesterday, Robert Lighthizer, a longtime protectionist, going back decades, much like Trump, will now lead the talks with China. That's a fairly strong signal that this idea that we're going to wait 90 days and then come to kind of an innocuous deal that both sides can say they had a victory with is, oh, no, we're looking to extract huge concessions that would, in fact, hurt American consumers, hurt American businesses, and hurt American productivity.
You know, it's remarkable. Something that you said at the outset in terms of how Republicans have sort of lost their way when it comes to being free traders, and also lost their way when it comes to reflecting on the not so distant past, particularly as we memorialize Bush 41 and think about the 80s. George Will's famous pronouncement when the wall came down, the Cold War is over and the University of Chicago won it. And the idea that the market and the market forces exposing the internal contradictions of the Soviet Union in the same way that market forces will expose the internal contradictions of the Chinese communists, I don't know why we don't learn the lesson, the economics lesson from the Cold War, and apply it to the Chinese.
Oh, I think you put it so well. This is exactly what I've seen, and that's probably why I think you put it so well. Here, conservatives in the 20th century remember how they were the leading proponents of economic liberalization and freedom for these imprisoned people in China and the Soviet Union that had been murdered by a failed ideology. And so now they achieve this freedom. Now the Chinese, still a very poor country, but increasingly very prosperous because they've adapted our market-focused ways. When conservatives say they're still communists, that's laughable. Visit China and you will see. They have embraced our ways amazingly, beautifully. And so they've done this. And so more of the world is free. And what do you see conservatives saying now? Look at Peter Berkowitz from Hoover Institution, this great Cold War institution. He was saying that all this freedom, all these imports from around the world, all this automation, which has defined U.S. prosperity, is causing men to have children out of wedlock, to be lazy, to develop opioid addictions. You have Orrin Cass from the Manhattan Institute saying, well, China doesn't play fairly. They subsidize our industry, their industries to our detriment. Well, wait a second. American conservatives have always said subsidized industries are the weakest because they are not exposed to the market signals that make them great. Orrin Cass also says the American worker is exposed to too much globalization, so we should give them care of the federal government subsidies. Amazing there is that conservatives cheer because Americans are now forgotten by this growth of freedom around the world. Are we kidding? Conservatives were all about this, and with good reason. This hasn't hurt the American worker. This has lived. You can never be hurt by the division of labor that's globalized. You can never be hurt by the rest of the world fighting feverishly to compete to serve you. Yet conservatives have turned tail. They're so confused by Trump's election that they no longer even believe what used to animate what was once a highly intellectual movement that's become ridiculous and protectionist.
What do you think President Trump could do or tweet to help the situation when the markets reopen on Friday?
He could say, I didn't mean it, I suppose.
Yeah. Yeah.
Can he walk the tweet back?
You know what I think he can do, and look, my frustration, I've had a debate with Steve Moore Live where he bashed China, and of course I defended its rise as something that's been great for the U.S. economy, which of course it has. And I pointed out, Steve, you never said this stuff until Trump was elected. What changed? And so the point is, there are people inside the administration who get it, who get that free trade never could injure the American worker and globalization could never injure any worker, that there are no losers in this. And so what you have to hope is that the wise minds inside the administration in different subtle ways try to walk this back and say, we are not going to let this happen. And I think the way you convince Trump is you say, look, one-term presidents aren't viewed as successes in history. If you want to be a two-term president, you better be focused on the economy. Tariffs harm the economy every time, and they certainly harm the stock market. So if you want to carry a weaker stock market into the 2020 election such that you lose, continue doing what you're doing. If not, go play golf for the last 2 years and win in 2020.
Right. And I mean, look, President Trump has made pronouncements that are Kudlowian in nature previously about the desire to get to a lower tariff environment across the board. This is a pathway to that. I don't know that I really believe that he believes that, but at least he's saying it. So he's said contradictory things on the topic, and maybe he'll do contradictory things on the topic. And so that's part of it. And Kudlow's influence is important. But I think the market, sure. I mean, he was obsessed with that for the first year. He's very quiet on it of late. And yesterday, the I word was mentioned, inverted yield curve, which has been the best predictor of recession for the last 60 years. So the narrowing of that yield curve, I assume, is something that's being communicated to him or should be.
Yeah, you know, usually it is. My sense is if you look closer at it, the yield curve basically predicts something well down the line. For one thing, I would say recessions are healthy. Recessions just are a sign of an economy cleansing itself.
Right down the line. But if down the line is a conversation about recession in 2020, that's not good.
Yeah. No, that's true. And so, look, anytime you limit the ability of people to receive from the rest of the world, you bring on an economic slowdown, because if the rest of the world has more difficulty selling to us, we can't sell our goods as readily. And this matters when you consider what a huge market China is. But let's also add that the greatest thing about free trade, for economic growth is that it makes it much more likely that we'll get to do the work that most elevates our skills. When you can divide up your work with more of the world, you can focus on what you do best. And we all know, all three of us get to do something we love every single day. That's why we're productive. And so free trade tariffs make it less likely that we get to do what we're good at. And so it saps our productivity. It's no mistake the 1930s were a slow decade. You put record tariffs on foreign goods, you force Americans into work that they're not as good at doing. And so this would be one of the effects of tariffs today. And so markets naturally price that. Trump's got to be made aware of that. But even if he doesn't want to believe it, he's got to want to believe that moving in this direction is going to have him force him to campaign on a lousy stock market, all the while the opposition running ads showing how much he was wrapping himself in the stock market when he was doing well.
John Tamney, director for the Center for Economic Freedom, as editor of RealClearMarkets.com and author of the book The End of Work, Why Your Passion Can Become Your Job. I'll have to explore how I can make my love of the xylophone my job at another time. John, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The more you listen, the more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer. Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Tis the season for giving, and that's what we're doing here. Doing something for others who are less fortunate than ourselves this holiday season. Hoping to feed, to provide food for a year and water for life for 3,000 children in Haiti. We're asking for a one-time donation of $80, but if all you want to give is 50 or 40, any donation would be much appreciated. And it takes a few seconds, 844-862-HOPE. That's 844-862-4673, or simply go to 560theanswer.com/food. We really need you to help us to push us past the finish line here in our annual campaign.
Again, Food for the Poor, five-star charity, Navigator rated. 95 cents of every dollar raised goes directly to the beneficiaries, in our case, 3,000 children in Haiti for whom we're going to provide food for a year and water for life. The other way to participate in this campaign to help out these kids, to participate in the season of giving, is through the Business Benefactor Program. $2,500 tax-deductible donation, and in return for your generosity, we offer some of our own 40 60-second commercials for your business to build brand equity. Maybe you got a deal going. Those ads will run primetime hours on a broadcast on the station, 5 a.m. to 8 p.m. on the weekdays. The way to enroll in that program, like so many businesses have, is call our sales manager, Anjanette, 847-472-8951. Anjanette at 847-472-8951. And you can join AmericanEagle.com, Palatine Complete Dental, Signature Bank, Twin Supplies of Oak Brook, Spiegel and Cahill, Attorneys at Law, Cafe Salsa, and others in helping us get to our goal of providing food and water for those 3,000 children and families in Haiti.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Listen to podcasts of Joe Walsh and Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on the AM 560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. I want to get to your calls in just a moment on the tariff man, self-described.
Did somebody say tariff man? May I?
Because he's a tariff man. Tariff man, taxing all of the foreign goods. Taxing all of the foreign goods. Taxing all of the foreign goods.
How many times have we used Rocket Man for parody songs? I mean, it's you know, well, multi-purpose. So, you know,
Ketchup Man when we talk about John Kerry because of his wife,
right?
Ketchup Man, Tariff Man, taxing all of our foreign goods. I mean, he couldn't have said it better. Thank you, Justin Kosick.
What Trump is saying, it's the path to prosperity. We're going to tax our way to prosperity. Isn't that what the left says? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. That's the kind of statement you would expect from a Joe Biden, who you remember famously said, we need to keep spending to prevent going bankrupt. paradoxical statements. And here's another one from Joe Biden yesterday. I'll be as straight with you as I can. I think I'm the most qualified person in the country to be president. Apparently, he's on a book tour, too.
Oh, he is?
I don't think he's selling out stadiums. I don't know.
The second man?
Wiggy
Top?
Because
he's the second man.
Backup?
Yeah,
he was in...
backup to the president.
Thank you for explaining.
Yeah, you're welcome.
He was in Missoula, Montana, and it. I just make mention of Biden, you know, because of the paradoxical statements he's wanted to offer, but also so I could offer up what Camille Paglia had to say in an interview with The Spectator about the Democrat field in 2020.
Oh, two people have dropped out, Michael Avenatti and Patrick Duvall. They announced yesterday that...
Duvall Patrick.
Duvall, excuse me.
Okay.
I'm sorry, Duvall Patrick. Well, I'm just letting you know in case you're keeping tabs over there.
Right.
You have to know who your starting lineup is.
Michael Dukakis also not running in 2020.
He's not. No. Yeah.
Jimmy Carter will not be a candidate in 2020.
No, but he will be there today for the service.
Camille Paglia gives her thoughts on it. I mean, this is great. She's just a ton of fun and truly a dizzying intellect. Despite the vast pack of candidates, no one yet seems to have the edge, says Paglia. I had high hopes for Kamala Harris, but she missed a huge opportunity to play a moderating statesman-like role and has already imprinted an image of herself as a ruthless inquisitor. It'll make it hard to pull votes across from party lines. And then she gets going. Screechy Elizabeth Warren has never had a snowball's chance in hell to appeal beyond upper-middle-class professionals of her glossy stripe. Kristen Gillibrand is a wobbly mediocrity. Cory Booker has all the gravitas of a cork.
Wow.
Andrew Cuomo is a yapping puppy with a long, muddy, bully boy tail.
Oh, my gosh.
Both Bernie Sanders, for whom I voted in 2016, said Paglia, and Joe Biden are way too old and creaky. To win the nation's broad midsection, the Democrat will need to project steadiness, substance, and warmth. Interesting. She's suggesting Governor Steve Bullock of Montana and also our very own Central Illinois Congresswoman Sherry Bustos. Who could be a Senate candidate in 2020 if Dick Durbin doesn't run. As for Hillary, she's pretty much damaged goods, but her perpetual sniping pity me tour shows no signs of abating. She still has a rabidly loyal following, and it's in her best interest to keep the speculation fires burning. She says, though, this is really interesting. Given how thoroughly she has already sabotaged the rising candidates by hogging the media spotlight, I suspect she wants Trump to win again. I don't see our stumbling, hacking, shopworn Evita yielding the spotlight willingly to any younger gal. I mean, that's just fun.
Wow.
That's just fun. All right, now it's going to be less fun because we have to talk about the tariff man, and I know...
Did you say tariff man? I mean...
Because he's a tariff man.
Brother.
Tariff man.
Yeah.
Taxing all of the foreign goods.
I am a tariff man. When people or countries come in to raid the great wealth of our nation, I want them to pay for the privilege of doing so. It will always be the best way to max out our economic power. We are right now taking in billions in tariffs. Make America rich again. What he's talking about there is taxing our way to prosperity. There's just no two ways about it. I am a tariff man is synonymous with saying I am a tax man. There's nothing in that tweet that is correct. And I'll explain my view, but I'll give you a chance to offer yours. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line. 64636-DA, turnkey.pro, text line. I am not, by the way, just had this exchange on Twitter with Steve on 88.
Yes.
Stop underestimating Trump. This isn't underestimating him. This isn't overestimating him. This is assessing what he is saying. And I would suggest that people stop underestimating the consequences of treating economic axioms as opinions. Let me refer you to Illinois as an example of what happens when you think the sort of laws of Econ 101 don't apply to you because you're the smartest guy in the room. You and your friends in government know just which dials to turn and levers to pull and the gradations for each. You don't. The most moral, number one, and most efficient way to organize a free society is through the mutually beneficial free exchange of goods and services. And if you don't believe that, then you don't believe in how our country became the wealthiest country the globe has ever seen. Corey in Woodlawn, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, Dan, I listen to you every morning, and while I do believe in what you're saying, I'm an Austrian guy myself.
Okay.
But what I can say is this: Trump is not just the president of the American consumer. He's also the president of the American producer. So for China to put so much tariffs on our goods, to have them sit at their borders and their people not consume them, isn't fair to American producers. So Trump is trying to offset that imbalance. So I think we should give him a shot. I mean, we've had presidents before that haven't even tackled this problem. I think we should give him a shot.
All right. Thanks for the call, Corey. Yeah, so, I mean, we've gone through this before when he first applied the tariffs on foreign steel and aluminum. You want to talk about producers. The number of businesses and employees that use steel and aluminum versus produce steel and aluminum. The number who use steel and aluminum to make their products is exponentially higher than the numbers that produce. So if this is about fairness and on balance, doing the most amount of good for the most amount of people, you're not doing so with those tariffs. And this whole fair trade canard,
yeah.
And Corey, as an Austrian, knows this. And I understand you want to give him a shot. And I've been trying to be patient. Hey, well, we're going to get to a low-tariff environment, and that's the goal here. I hear that from Larry Kudlow. I hear that intermittently from President Trump, and I'm starting to get skeptical of it. And if that's not the goal, and if that's not where we're going, then we're going to have a problem. And so, by the way, is President Trump in 2020.
Yeah, he will.
We should welcome China subsidizing their companies. Again, the view on this is through the eye of the consumer. The industrial policy proponents are suggesting you tax the poor to subsidize the rich, are suggesting that government is best positioned to pick winners and losers in with respect to sector or industries within sector. That is not true. And there's no evidence that is available to make it true. You can make it true for individual companies that have been selected, but not writ large. And Trump can't suspend those laws of economics. Chris and Joliet.
Hello.
Hi, Chris. Chris, you're on.
Oh, Chris. Morning. I think we're ignoring how all of this got here in the first place. I mean, I agree with you on pretty much everything, and maybe you can change my mind on free trade. But the reality of it is, like, my parents' generation walked out of high school right into middle-class jobs and factories and stuff. The companies that you brought up earlier, Apple and Nike, they circumvent the issue by producing their products in places like Vietnam and China itself. So they're making money, but they're not producing jobs here. And the reality of it is, at some point, we turned from manufacturing these goods, and it all turned at the point when we started pushing free trade. We don't make things here anymore. Mm-hmm. And the things we do make here are facing heavy tariffs in other countries. So, I mean, have we sacrifice the growth of our middle class for free trade?
No, it's quite thanks for the call, Chris. Look, it's quite the opposite. I mean, you think Smoot-Hawley is what created a wealthier middle class post-World War II? Policies like the Smoot-Hawley tariff that deepened the Great Depression? No. No. That's just not true. Let me just enlist this piece from Art Carden, who's an economist in Forbes, talking about the cheaters. Company that's unfair, this fairness issue. I thought that's what the left talks about. Government-imposed fairness. You know what government-imposed fairness is? Unfairness. Because the government is picking and choosing through force Imagine the Chinese government was to try to make China great again by subsidizing steel producers. By subsidizing steel producers, the Chinese government lowers costs for people who use steel, which is to say just about everyone, and especially American consumers of electronics, home appliances, cars, structural steel, cookware, residential construction, commercial construction, heavy equipment, staples, paperclips, you name it. The American steel industry contracts because of artificially cheap foreign steel, but other American industries expand. To use just one example, cheaper steel makes bridges and especially commercial construction more affordable. The result is better infrastructure, more opportunities in the construction industry. Or consider cars. If we can import steel at lower prices, car factories in Alabama, like Mercedes, Honda, Hyundai, can crank out more cars. The big winners are American consumers, not foreigners as a whole. The losers, paradoxically, are not American workers, but foreign taxpayers. Distributionally, the effect of such subsidies is perverse. Subsidies to steel manufacturers in China tax the relatively poor Chinese in order to buy nice things for relatively wealthy Americans. If the Chinese government is doing anything blameworthy, and make no mistakes, it is being blameworthy by robbing the poor to subsidize the rich. And so that's the policy we should pursue here. Pete in Crete.
Yeah, hi, Dan. You know, there's so many flaws with what you guys have been saying.
Oh, really?
Well, we'll start with what the gentleman brought up with the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union was never an economic power that was competing against us. The Chinese are. And if we believe Mitt Romney, they're one of our chief global adversaries. So one of the results of these tariffs, we're not tariffing all countries. So there's competitors, cheap competitors to China, like India, Korea, and
why don't we have a trade war with India?
Hold on, but that's the point, Dan. A lot of production has been leaving China, and it's been accelerated due to the tariffs, and it's putting a lot of pressure on China to lower their own. So you what I'm saying, there's countries, your companies are leaving China and putting manufacturing plants in places like India that we do not tariff because they're a developing country. China is not a developing country. That's the only reason they were tariff nation in the first place.
You're wrong. It is a developing country.
China's not a developing country.
Pete, China is mainly agricultural still. You have 1 million people migrating to cities a day. It's changing. It is a communist, centrally controlled regime. It is a government that controls the majority of the means of production, which is why it doesn't realize the strength of its 1 billion people.
Okay, but Dan, are you telling me you believe that China is not the second largest economic power in the world right now?
Yeah, I understand, well, by their phony baloney GDP numbers, but and so what? So we should emulate China. Is that what you're saying? We should emulate Chinese policies with respect to tariffs.
No, Dan, let's back up. Okay,
we're going to tax our way to prosperity, Pete. But
look at steel. You mentioned steel with China, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, in China, the whole reason they were subsidizing their steel is to put our plants out of business. The ends were not to give us cheap steel. It's to corner the market, to close their competition, to artificially lower the price until the companies around that are competing against them would go out of business.
Uh-huh.
That is not in America. We don't allow companies to do those things.
Yeah.
So
yeah, we wouldn't allow
a company to get away with that, but we're going to allow China to do that to our and put our companies out of business.
Thanks for the call, Pete. Tony in Plainfield.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I had a comment regarding how it's impacting jobs. The company I work for has operations all over the world, and we provide manufacturing services for other companies, and they're always chasing, as we are as consumers, they're always chasing a better deal, a lower price, but they want quality. So we get that business because we can deliver a good product, high quality, at a good price. The tariffs are costing us some business because we have to raise our price point to incorporate those tariffs. And jobs and activity that would be here locally in the States, we're having to move it to our Mexico and China operations to stay competitive with our competitors. So it's hurting us in the form of
potential jobs and new opportunities. So, you know, our friends out there that are crying about we should label China as the bad guy or whomever, it's really not working in that regard, helping us. It's hurting us.
Thanks for the call, Tony. I mean, here, Thomas Hazlitt. When you set off a trade war, you have no idea how it's going to end. You're going to be blindsided by all kinds of consequences. You do not make America great again by raising the price to Americans, which is what a tariff does. And that's what Tony is talking about. And if you think you have the secret knowledge, you don't. If you think Trump has the secret knowledge of how to order a 330 million person, $20 trillion economy in a global context better than the free exchange of goods and services between consenting individuals, you're wrong. First principles. First principles. And there's no way of getting around it. If you want to choose a government-centric way of thinking about free society, then you're conceding that we're not going to have a free society. You're saying we should emulate closed societies. It's absurd. And the facts simply do not support being the tariff man.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Real quick, the fish experts at Bonefish Grill want to satisfy your weekend cravings with a new brunch menu featuring favorites like Bang Bang Shrimp Eggs Benedict. New dishes include crab cake, ranchero seasoned avocado toast. So I'm getting hungry. So visit bonefishgrill.com for the full menu. And right now, you have the chance to win a $50 gift card to Bonefish Grill at go to 560theanswer.com/bonefish. That's 560theanswer.com/bonefish.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Geneva School District 304, teachers are on strike. Provided some data yesterday about median compensation and associated median property tax bill in Geneva School District 304, because that's how the school is being financed, by liquidating homes in the community, 2.57% of home value, 2.5 times the national average. There was a point made, some reaction we got, including one husband of a teacher tweeted at me.
Uh-oh.
About $23 million being held by the school district in reserves. It's just sitting there. He makes a good point. That $23 million in reserves that District 304 has,
yeah,
should be immediately returned to the taxpayers, where it will be put to higher and better use. I don't like governments piling up huge reserves.
$23 million seems like a lot for Geneva School District.
If you need, I think it's something like $90 million in taxes to finance operations. If you need more money, then you go back to the taxpayers and you ask for it. But in the meantime, governments with reserves or people with more money in their pockets? I'll take taxpayers with more money in their pockets making individual decisions. So that's a good point. We looked here at KaneCountyReporter.com. We got all the salaries. All the salaries. 483 District 304 employees receive a collective $60 million in 2017. Of the employee pay packages analyzed, 316 of the 483, so that's 65%, will receive more than $100,000. 28 earn $200,000, including the top compensated employee in the district, Principal Thomas Rogers, $330,000. Base salary for 9 months, again here,
yeah,
$156,000, total compensation $330,000. Base salary, $145,000 for another principal named Terrence Blue.
How much? I'm sorry.
145 grand. Total compensation, 306 grand. Another principal, Lawrence Bidlack, 144 grand. Total compensation, 304 grand. Assistant Associate District Superintendent 1, Assistant Associate District Superintendent 2, both 140 grand. 290 grand total compensation package.
I'd love to see what their job responsibilities are.
And now, I mean, and you know, obviously you got some people with different years in and different graduation or different education levels and so forth. And not everybody's there. But again, two-thirds have compensation packages over 100 grand. Interestingly, the teachers have seemed to have started to not disclose what their actual demand is. Because when it first circulated that they wanted 18% over four,
right,
that they want single teachers to have the district pick up
more of their health insurance.
100%. Right. And for families, for to go from 65 to 75% district pickup, not being received so well. So Dean Malmgren tweeted out in response to a district missive on the topic, "This is a fluff piece. What differences remain? What is your side? Why is your side unwilling to budge? As a parent in the school district," so for those who say, "I can't comment," I love this one. We get this too, Hinsdale. "You can't comment because you don't live in the school district." Well, I'm a taxpayer, so I get to comment. And also, it's my job. But here's the thing. As a parent in the school district, it's impossible to plan our lives around this nonsense without clear information about how far apart the two sides are and why. This is a parent in the district responding to the district's pronouncement on the topic that is not specific. So they don't want to give you information. Well, at least the union side, which is the district side.
And then another woman's claiming that our main goal is to bring some of the starting pay of beginning teachers up. And they do want to maintain the salary for the teachers that are on the top end of the salary.
Yeah.
Well, one teacher said that if I teach in Glenbard and then came to Geneva right now, I would take a $25,000 pay cut.
So?
Then stay in Glenbard.
or perhaps the Glenbard taxpayers should be having a conversation about their the point is, none of this is sustainable.
Right.
Public school employees pay into the state pension system approximately 3% of what they stand to collect in retirement. You understand this? I'm not talking about what they pay in each check. I'm talking about what they're putting in versus what they expect to get out. They are putting in, public school employees paying to the state pension system, approximately 3% of what they stand to collect in retirement. So $30,000 in for every $1 million received. And you know who makes up the difference? Yeah.
Yeah. Taxpayers.
$30,000 in for every $1 million received. Anybody want to talk about fairness? Where are the Democrat socialists who want to talk about fairness? Where are the unions? I want to talk about fairness. These are not pensioners. They're pension heirs. This is the new upper middle income strata. And I do mean strata because, unlike people who do well for themselves in the private sector, save, make good investments, whatever, that return is not guaranteed. Defined benefit pension plans, return guaranteed. It's nice. They take the guesswork out of it. I mean, it's nice if you're on the receiving end. And I mean the benefit end, not the receiving end, the bill end, which is where the rest of us are. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line. I'll tweet this out at Dan Prof. Go look at the salaries, names and salaries. And I will say what I say all the time. Two
we
things.
Love teachers.
Great teachers like a great artist.
Yep.
I was the beneficiary of great teachers in Catholic school, but the beneficiary of great teachers nonetheless.
I was a beneficiary of great teachers in public school.
I think those great teachers would dispute that you were a beneficiary, not that they were great teachers. I'm all for people trying to maximize their earnings, public sector, private sector. I get it. you can't make this math work. Just, I don't know how else to say it. Is there a debate to be had about 30 grand in for $1 million out guaranteed? Is there a debate to be had about people making 50 or 60 grand being forced to finance not just $300,000 and $400,000 salaries, these huge six-figure salaries for these layers of bureaucracies, and not just in school districts, but particularly in school districts, but then the $5, $7, $8 million guaranteed pension on the back end? What's the argument? Structurally, not individually, not because somebody's not is trying to maximize their earning potential. I'm saying, how does that system make any sense? How do you think it's sustainable? And nobody wants to answer that question, who, you know, wants to protect the status quo, because there's nothing to say except I benefit from the status quo. That's why I want to keep it. Okay. At least you're being honest. I would appreciate a little bit more honesty on the topic. Megan on the South Side.
Hi, good morning, guys. I'm just, you know, is that why, Dan, what you just said about benefiting from the status quo? I mean, I thought pay was supposed to be commensurate with, you know, the amount of experience or how difficult or how much schooling your job requires. But the children in America are not benefiting from this. So why are the salaries so high?
Well, thanks for the call, Megan, because they've captured the district personnel. They capture the school board members in many cases. So you're sort of negotiating with yourself. And they've snookered so many people to think all that matters is inputs. And if you don't support writing blank checks to your local schools, then you hate teachers, kids, and education. As mind-numbingly anti-reason as that statement is, people buy it all over the place, particularly in this state that is afflicted by the most virulent strain of Stockholm Syndrome in the Western Hemisphere. Joe in Franklin Park.
You know, I'm really getting a little tired of people demonizing these teachers. This is the total benefits package that these teachers were promised when they first started and went to college to get this.
Thanks for the call, Joe. What you said is laughable, Joe in Franklin Park.
They were promised.
Well,
there are no guarantees in anything.
Right. You can bind people in perpetuity. That's what that promise is, number one. Number two, nobody's demonizing teachers. Just the opposite. But this Joe in Franklin Park's a perfect example we're talking about. They can't hear anything. They can't hear. They refuse to hear what people are actually saying. Nobody wants to take away anything that somebody has earned. And Joe in Franklin Park wants to bitch like a child about, you know, demonizing this and being mean to that rather than address the substance of the matter. So keep bitching, Joe, in Franklin Park.
Well, things are changing. I mean, one of my firefighter friends said the new recruits, the rookies that are coming in, they're not going to have a pension. They're going to go immediately to a 401k plan.
Well,
just like all of us. I mean, because there's no money there.
Well, the firefighters' pension fund hasn't gone away.
No, it hasn't gone away, but they're going to have to change the way they do business because
not
it's
yet,
a
it
joke.
Hasn't.
Right. Right. They're still working it out.
It's 20% funded.
Yeah.
So then what does that say about how sustainable the system is if you have firefighters talking about putting rookies into a 401ks? And if that's good enough for rookies, then why is it good enough for everybody going forward, including existing workers, but on a date certain prospectively going forward? Or are we just going to be like Joe in Franklin Park, a crybaby, a bedwetter, a neo-Luddite? We can choose that path, and then you think the reckoning won't come? Okay. So those promises that we know are unsustainable, that the politicians made, that they knew were unsustainable, that they did in conjunction with public sector union bosses, like skipping pension payments, which the teachers' unions were all on board for in the 90s. Go ahead. Take that. Get what they promised at any cost. And that's the attitude. And so I'm glad Joe in Franklin Park called in. I hope people heard that because I hear him. He doesn't hear me, but I hear him. The position is we will liquidate everything you own if that's what it takes to get the guaranteed benefit levels that we were promised at the outset, even if it's not sustainable. Even if you want to talk about changing things prospectively, not interested in that conversation. Okay. No problem. Todd on the South Side.
How you doing? Great show.
Thanks.
I got a quick question. These teachers want to get more money, hit the taxpayers. Do they have a residency requirement that they have to live in the district and pay the taxes?
I don't know if they have to live in Geneva to be a teacher in the district. Thanks for the call, Todd. I don't know if there's a residence requirement or not.
I don't know.
But, I mean, again, two-thirds of the employees have $100,000-plus compensation packages. That's individually. The median household income in Geneva, which is an upper-middle income community, is like $95,000. Household income. That disparity is not as great as it is in a lot of other places, particularly lower middle income communities. Cindy and Joliet.
Hey, Dan. Good morning. Hi, Amy. I'm, you know, school educator, and there's multiple layers to this problem. Obviously, you know that, Dan. But I will tell you this, that the teacher's retirement system, TRS, has changed tiers. Like, I got in on Tier 1, which is the old school equations, how the actuarial set it up back in the day when people, you know, died when they were, like, 75. You know, there's 90-year-old retirees that have been retired, you know, two of them for 35 and 40 years. So that's a screwed-up part of that equation, first of all. Secondly, if you get yourself positioned correctly in many districts, and I saw this firsthand, your colleagues at the higher level will basically put you in line and groom you for top positions. So that's where you get the associate superintendent one, associate superintendent two. This usually happens about the fourth year before you're ready to retire, because the last 3 years of your administrative work is what your pension is based on. And that's that's a problem there. There's a lot of good old boy stuff going on, and I saw it, and I left the district because of it, because I was not going to get caught up in the bureaucracy and not get promoted because of merit.
Would you say that the retirement age is also a problem? 55?
Well, you know what? I work with a lot of older teachers, and let me tell you, they need to retire. I heard one screaming at a kid that came in late to school yesterday. You know, she's like, what do you mean you told your sister you didn't want to come to school? You get your butt here every day. Mm. And I thought, gee, why does this kid not want to come to school? But he's going to be faced with some woman that should be retiring who thinks she's like the superintendent, but really she answers the phones. So, you know, it's just, oh, man, it's ugly, Dan. And, I mean, I could sit down with you and your head would spin.
Thanks.
Of the stories I could tell you regarding the finances in districts.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I had, when I went back for my master's degree, I had a driver's ed teacher in my class with me who said, I would never be an administrator, but I want to move over on the pay lane. So you could get a master's degree in school administration and continue to be a driver's ed teacher just so you could have that increase in your salary. And as you move in your gears on the grid, you moved yourself over in the lane too, and you got more pay.
Yeah,
now,
right.
Why does the driver's ed teacher get extra pay and the school district paid for some of his schooling to be a school administrator when there's no intention of using that degree? Now, that is a problem. I have a problem with that ethically. I have a problem with that. So there's a lot going on, you know, and I work real hard to keep my nose to the grindstone, and, you know, there's just a lot of layers to this problem. It's just not teachers are overpaid and they only work 180 days. Teachers do work in the summer with professional development that helps them move on the lanes to get more pay. But, you know, they're talking to parents at 7 and 8 o'clock at night. You know, you are grading a lot of papers. If you've got 30 kids in your classroom and you're teaching 5 subjects, 1 assignment per day, per kid, per subject, do the math. It's a lot of work, but you know what? Hey, guess what? When you went to school to be an educator, you said, I can do this job. And you had plenty of pre-teaching experience and student teaching experience.
where you could have decided to opt out. So I don't want to hear about these crybaby teachers that say, oh, you know, it's so much work. These kids are so disrespectful. Yeah, that's part of it. But kids have always been disrespectful. It's just now at a really high level.
Thanks.
Because I've been a teacher, too. You know, it's a multi-layer thing,
yeah.
Dan.
Yeah.
Have a good day.
Thanks for the call, Cindy. Appreciate it. Here's something else, too, to layer in. This report out this morning by WirePoints.com. $166 billion in retiree health insurance benefits to public sector workers over the next 30 years. That's Illinois' promise. Actuaries say the state should have $73 billion invested today so it can make all those payments in the future. You know how much it has invested? Should have $73 billion today to finance $166 billion in retiree health care benefits for public sector workers. And I'm the bad guy. You know how much the state has invested?
How much?
Zero. $73 billion unfunded liability problem on retiree health care benefits. You want to tell me again, Joe in Franklin Park, how this is all going to work out?
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook, or read about it in the paper, hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. Let freedom ring this afternoon at 2 with Sean Hannity, right before Joe Walsh at 5 on AM 560, The Answer.
Because he's a tariff man. Tariff man. Taxing all of the foreign goods. Taxing all of the foreign goods.
Taxing all the foreign goods.
Yeah, we had a little discussion about this earlier in the show. And I tried to kind of walk through basic economic principles. I didn't get very far with a lot of people. But what about this? Let me try this angle.
All right.
What about how Trump's tariffs? I'm a tariff man. We're right now taking in billions of tariffs, billions of dollars in tariffs. Make America rich again. We're going to tax our way to prosperity. Trump policy, Trump tariffs. Tariffs, period. No matter whose name you attach to them, Smoot, Ollie, Trump. How about the beneficiaries? How are they doing? The intended beneficiaries, steel and aluminum. AK Steel Holding Company, Century Aluminum. All down double digits as of 3 months in, 4 months into the tariffs. Double-digit declines in share price, hundreds of millions of dollars in market valuation lost. And then, of course, we know what's happening to steel and aluminum users. And we know what's happening to agribusiness, soybean farmers, for example, because we want to, like, trade anecdotes. The Trump tariff proponents, or the Trump opponents, so whatever he does is good. And it's okay if he thinks he can suspend the forces of economics. Well, you just want to use anecdotes about who he's protecting. Well, here are the people he's protecting, and this is what winning a trade war looks like. Double-digit stock price declines and millions, hundreds of millions of dollars in market valuation loss. The problem I think you have on the producer side in the U.S. is that the industry is still as inefficient as it has been, said Michael Widmer, the head of Metal Markets Research at Bank of America. Okay. Temporary trade truce on Monday. Full-on celebration of tariffs on Tuesday.
And then we lose money in the deal.
Not good for American consumers.
No.
I mean, I don't know how anybody thinks that if this is his actual posture, that all of the hope associated with Kudlow's pronouncements and Trump's intermittent support for those pronouncements, that this is all the means to get to the ends of a lower tariff environment, the removal of trade barriers, zero subsidies, zero tariffs, you know, that laudable goal that Kudlow repeats with religious fervor. If that's not it, per Trump's tweet yesterday, then we got a real problem on our hands, and so does President Trump. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Steve Moore, chief economist for CNN and Wall Street Journal columnist. Steve, thanks for being with us.
Go away. I don't want to talk to you today.
Exactly. Well, I'm a I'm a tariff man. I mean, I'm a tax man. That's what he said.
Well, I knew I was going to get a stern lecture from you and Amy today, so
yes.
I was gripping for this. But look, I think here's the thing that I think you guys miss. We are in a cold war with China right now. China is engaged in incredibly abusive trade practices. They steal, they cheat. Trump is basically standing toe-to-toe with Beijing. And I think what happened here was over the weekend, the White House thought they had a deal. They had a handshake deal with President Xi. But guess what? We learned again that the Chinese, you can't take them for their word. In addition to cheating and stealing, they also lie. And so what we thought they had agreed to, they didn't think they had agreed to. And the whole thing kind of, at least for temporarily now, blew up. Trump was said that, look, we won't slap tariffs on you for 90 days if we can get these, this trade deal done. I think that the market totally overreacted here. The investors and you, Dan and Amy, still don't get Donald Trump. This guy is a master negotiator. He is going to win on China. I want to say that again to your audience.
So
Trump is going to win here.
Okay.
And when he wins here, you two are going to eat your words and you're going to say Donald Trump was right all along.
I want him to win, but this is not the way to go about it.
They're going to stop stealing our intellectual property. They're going to open up their markets to American companies. It's going to be good for American workers. And I rest my case.
Well, why? And you have to admit that his tweet yesterday... when he said President Z and I wanted this deal to happen.
I hated the tweet.
But if not, remember, I'm the tariff man.
I know. Look, Amy, you're like these liberals. You take Trump literally, not seriously. What Trump was doing there was basically engaging in some, brinkmanship. He was basically saying to the Chinese, look, you better get serious about making these concessions, or we're going to slap you I'm a tariff man. I'm going to slap you with these punitive tariffs. I'm not in favor of the steel tariffs, by the way. I agree with you guys. The steel and aluminum tariffs have been a disaster, no question about it. So I'm totally with you on that. Where I part company, I think, with you guys is I think we can't. If you're in an abusive relationship with someone, you either got to change their behavior or get out of the relationship. And I want Dan to explain to me why we should continue to allow them to cheat and steal, and they have giant tariffs on us. Why should we not retaliate?
Because you poke your eye out, so I poke my eye out. Doesn't make any sense.
Except that this is going to do much more. They have warehouses full of merchandise that they can't sell in the United States right now. It's putting a real pinch on their economy. They are suffering as a result of this.
Right.
They are going to back down. You just got to keep the pressure on them because we can't live with the status quo.
Why will they back down, Steve, other than make overtures that they'll back down but not back down? And here's the question is, isn't intellectual piracy, the offloading of American technology, that is not a bug in their communist command control system. That's a feature. That's their business model. You're saying they're going to give up their business model.
You're exactly right.
They're going to give up their business model.
We shouldn't be doing business with them. You can't, I think Trump has a good point, and I want you, maybe I need Amy's reaction to this. I mean, what Trump was asked the other day when he was asked about, starting this trade war with China, he said, look, he laughed. He said, I didn't start this trade war with China. They started it 10 years ago, and we didn't even recognize we were in a trade war with them. And they continue to, I talk to businessmen and women all the time, as you guys do. They say it's almost impossible to do business in China because, you have to give up your trade secrets, you have to give up your patents, sometimes you have to even give up ownership.
But we're
going
to have to change their culture. I have a friend who lived there for a year, and she told me yesterday, she said the difference is in China, they think one man's idea is everyone's idea.
Exactly.
And she said, in the U.S., if it's your idea, then you get a patent and you're the one who makes money.
Well, exactly. So we can't sell stuff to them. That's like saying, we believe in thievery and you don't believe in thievery. It's like you have a trade deal with your next door neighbor, but they keep stealing from you. That's not trade. That's not free trade, Dan, Amy. That's theft. And it's not just the theft. It's the fact that they have, how can you justify the gigantic tariffs that they impose on us? It sounds like what you guys are just for is we just buy anything from China, but they don't have to do anything to accommodate our businesses. And I'm sorry, I don't see the world that way.
Are we to look at economics through the eye of the consumer or the eye of the state?
Well, this is America first, guys. We're going to put American companies first, and when you put American companies first, you put American businesses first. And if people don't have jobs, they can't buy stuff. I mean, it's that simple. And there's no question about it that these abusive China behavior. You go to places where the factories have left. It's in part that's because they have lower labor costs, but in part it's because we can't sell our stuff over there.
Do you find it problematic? You know, gamesmanship is sort of what you said it was, but we're taking in billions in tariffs, make America rich again. That's what the president says. Does that not sound like taxing our way to prosperity?
I don't like tariffs. I said this on CNN last night. I said, the one lesson we should have learned from yesterday is, I don't like tariffs. Investors don't like tariffs. It's bad for workers. And so I'm not in favor of tariffs. But what I am in favor of is taking action against China. I really do believe that we're facing the new Soviet Union in China. And I think we have to wake up to that. They are not marching towards freedom. They're marching away from freedom. They're human rights violations.
They're communist thugs. Right.
I just don't look. I'm all in favor of free trade with Europe and Canada and Mexico and countries that play by the rules. I just don't see how you can have a free trade arrangement with a country that is so abusive in terms of their and they are laughing behind our backs. And incidentally, the reason I think ultimately that China is going to make concessions, they can't grow if they don't. We're using leverage, and that's the thing you don't understand about Donald Trump. He is a master negotiator because he understands the concept of leverage. Mm. We have leverage over China because they have to have access to America's markets, or their economy will not grow. Already their economic growth rate has been cut in half. Their stock market is down 20%. I mean, either they're going to suffer a lot of pain, or they're going to change their behavior.
Let me switch gears and just get your reaction to Macron. He has some egg on his face in Paris. Literally, he got pelted with eggs when he spoke at the site of the riots sponsored by those yellow vests.
This is an amazing story.
Yeah.
I mean, this is an amazing story of how wacko the green movement is, not just in the United States, but around the world. These people, I've said many times, I've said it on your show, the most dangerous movement in the world today is the radical green movement. They're crazy people. Listen to what they're saying, folks. If you call yourself a member of the Green Party, these are people who want to destroy our energy production. Listen to what Alexandra Cortez is saying. We're not going to use any more oil, gas, coal, nuclear power. We're going to shut down American energy. Somehow we're going to, run our, economy on solar and wind power. We get about 4 or 5% of our energy today from that. It will dramatically raise the cost of energy. It's happening in Paris and in France, which is supposed to be a quote progressive country. And guess who's rioting? The farmers, the students, the labor union workers, because they don't want to pay $7 a gallon for gasoline. And folks, if we follow that model, the wacko, climate change, green energy, folks, we're headed. That's exactly what they want in the United States. $6 and $7 gasoline and a doubling of your utility prices. Won't that be wonderful for the American economy?
All right. He is Steve Moore, Wall Street Journal columnist, chief economist for CNN. He's got a hungry dog we got to let him get to. Steve,
thanks for joining us, folks. Right. Trumponomics is working.
All right. Thanks, Steve.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM 560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today.
We want to thank business benefactors, including Twin Supplies Company of Oak Brook, Signature Bank, Chris Jacobs and Associates, Century 21 Affiliate in Algonquin, Palatine Complete Dental, AmericanEagle.com, Cafe Salsa, Spiegel and Cahill Law Firm, Matthew Hickey, Attorney at Law. And why do we want to thank them, Amy?
Because they made a generous donation of $2,500, which is tax deductible. The money goes to Food for the Poor. And as a way of saying thank you, they're a part of the AM 560 family now, Dan. We're giving them 40 one-minute commercials that will air, not on the weekends. We're not putting you there. We're putting you there Monday through Friday from 5 a.m. to 8 p.m. prime hours here on AM 560 The Answer. And Nate and I say Tom Sudeikis from Precision Payroll, he began his relationship with us as a business benefactor. So kudos to these companies. You're going to want to take advantage of this because these slots will sell out. Call Anjanette. Call her right now. Even if you have any questions, just call her. 847-472-8951. That's 847-472-8951. And ask her about the Business Benefactor Program. Again, the money goes to help those in need this holiday season, and it will take your business to the next level.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. So, Special Counsel Bob Mueller recommending no prison time for retired General Michael Flynn, Trump's fleeting NSA, suggesting that over the last year plus, some 19 interviews have provided, quote unquote, substantial assistance to the Special Counsel's investigation.
Yeah, and in that memo, they said Flynn's information helped Mueller build a criminal case. But against whom? We don't know because it was so heavily redacted.
So we've got, five pleas by Trump associates, and nothing has anything to do with any criminal conspiracy related to the 2016 election, 2016 campaign. As far as we know, this was the subject of a conversation that Tucker Carlson had with noted Russian studies professor Stephen F. Cohen, formerly of Princeton and NYU. And Cohen said this Russiagate investigation sans any evidence, which has yet to materialize, and the people who are promoting it. It's not just fact-free. It's actually dangerous to our national security, Stephen F. Cohen explains.
Because of these Russiagate allegations, clearly, that you've just discussed with Professor Dershowitz, that Trump feels not free to deal with Putin in terms of national security. Think back to John Kennedy during the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962. I mean, that was the model of what we should never do again. But the lesson also was is that President Kennedy was free to negotiate with the Kremlin leader to avoid nuclear war. That is not the case today. And that's why I think the danger of war with Russia, at least since the Cuban Missile Crisis, is greater in my lifetime, in history, than it's ever been because of these Russiagate allegations for which I've yet to see any authentic evidence. And we saw that last week. Trump either felt he could not or he lacked the resolve to go ahead and meet with Putin, even though this meeting is desperately needed. There's a new crisis every month with Russia.
And we got another one this morning, Wall Street Journal reporting that Putin is threatening an arms race as the U.S. prepares to exit that nuclear treaty that Russia continued to violate. Cohen saying those people, mainly Democrats, his fellow travelers once upon a time, are the responsible party here.
Russiagate allegations that Trump is somehow under the influence of the Kremlin, there's no evidence for it. So in my mind, whoever promotes this Russiagate allegations, and it's primarily Democrats, not only, but primarily the Democratic Party, is endangering our national security. Now, that's not a popular thing for a person such as myself, who used to live on the liberal reservation, to say, and people denounce me for saying it. But it's the real truth based on my 50 years of studying American-Russian relations. We're in a very dangerous situation, Tucker, and this has to stop, and has to stop very soon.
For an additional academic perspective on that issue, as well as the Bush 41 legacy and the Khashoggi matter, many topics cover with Art Sear, who's the Claussen Distinguished Professor at Carthage College, just north of us there in scenic Kenosha, Wisconsin.
Oh, yeah.
You can keep that one on the list for Peyton and Eli.
What's their mascot?
Not Division I, so I don't know. Art Sear, what's Carthage College's mascot?
We have Torchy, kind of a colorful cartoon character. The Carthage Flame is our symbol.
Carthage Flame.
And it's a kind of a scary-looking individual in a costume with a flame on top of his or her head instead of hair.
And the reports of you being
I'll send you a picture.
And I'd love to see Torchy.
The reports of you being Torchy are unfounded, I presume.
Absolutely.
Okay,
yeah.
Very good.
No, I don't think... Yeah, if I applied, they'd reject me for sure.
All right.
I'm too old, too boring, I don't have enough hair.
Well, what do you think about Stephen F. Cohen's assessment of Russiagate and its national security implications?
Well, we're certainly I'm certainly in good company, and we are with someone as distinguished and senior as he is. The Cuban Missile Crisis, I remember very vividly. I was working in a supermarket in Los Angeles, a prime target area, after school. And when I showed up for work the day after President Kennedy's speech, the market was jammed. I mean, literally jammed with people. You could smell the fear. Nobody stole anything, as far as we could tell, but they cleaned the store out completely. It was a very distinctive time in my life, and for the first time, I really smelled collective fear. Good practice for later on in that turbulent decade.
Well, but
we don't. In my humble opinion, we don't face anything like that today. War by accident. The better analogy is World War One. We're at the 100th anniversary of the armistice. Mm-hmm. Just passed it. War by accident. Accidental miscalculation. It was close during the Cuban Missile Crisis, but given the nature of our leadership, as Professor Cohen described, and the uncertainties, especially in the Balkans and the Middle East, where the First World War began, I think that's a good analogy.
Well, and what specifically, though, about his suggestion that this is a time when Trump and Putin should be talking and not a time when Trump should feel, for domestic political reasons, like he can't make any overtures to Putin?
Well, I think that's a very good observation. There was more respect for authority in the early 60s, and we tended to defer more to presidential initiative. In that sense, I think he's spot on at the working level in terms of diplomats and military people, as well as scientists. There's a good deal of ongoing interchange with both Russia and China. There's obviously a lot of economic intercourse that was not characteristic of the Cold War period, especially the height of the Cold War in the 60s. And I do believe that things are more reassuring at certain levels. But he's a very distinguished as well as very opinionated individual, and as are you guys. So I appreciate you having him on the show. It was instructive.
Thank you. President Trump, yes, is still sticking. I don't know if he's sticking by his story about Khashoggi's murder and who ordered the hit. But yesterday, the CIA director sat down with some senators who said, you know, he'd be found guilty within 30 minutes judged by his jury in a smoking saw instead of a smoking gun. How do you think President Trump should move forward with his relationship with the Crown Prince in the future?
I think he should, in this case, he should keep his distance from the Crown Prince. In this world, again, in contrast to earlier times in history, thanks to a pervasive media, including you good people, and the fact that the rule of law, believe it or not, is a good deal more widespread than any time before in the world's history, thanks in part to the growth of market economics, you can't behave like an imperious dictator and an imperious killer in ways that were possible in earlier times. The U.S., again, looking at things strategically and historically, we've just recently become, again, a major net exporter, and I mean major net exporter, not only of finished gasoline, but petroleum products generally, thanks significantly to fracking. And we're not as dependent on the Middle East, an unstable region, or any other part of the world in the way that we were from the early 1960s when we went into deficit in terms of petroleum trade and quite recently. So these are good times in terms of the resources of the U.S.
I wanted to get your perspective on Bush 41's legacy in the foreign policy arena. Richard Haass, who was in the National Security Council. And the Council on Foreign Relations as well. He wrote about Bush that he left the country and the world considerably better off than he found them, that on balance, because of his management of the end of the Cold War and repelling Saddam Hussein's invasion into Kuwait, that he left the world a safer place when he left. Is that your assessment?
Yes, indeed. I know Richard Haass very slightly, and I certainly follow his work, like a lot of other people, including General Scowcroft and certainly James Baker, consistently with people who worked for that president. Women and men, I'm consistently impressed by how effective they are, and I believe he's spot on. Tom Clawson, who headed the World Bank during that period, served under Reagan, and our alum, like to say that Ronald Reagan helped us feel better about ourselves and restored national self-confidence after some tough years. I believe that's true. Bush's extraordinary executive ability and his ability to prosecute collectively the very challenging Gulf War brilliantly, I think, is testament to the fact that his legacy is practical policy. Clausen was a very successful executive. He ran Bank of America twice and in between ran the World Bank. And he was nominated by Carter. He was acquainted with Reagan as head of the Bank of America when Reagan was governor. But it was interesting to me. I was fortunate to become acquainted with Tom Clausen after I took the job here. The one he was really close to was George H.W. Bush. And Bush's executive ability, quite different from political talent, I think is a big part of his very positive legacy.
He is Art Sear. He is the Clausen, as in Tom Clausen, distinguished professor at Carthage College in Kenosha, Wisconsin. Professor Sear, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you, folks. It's an honor.
Take care.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Well, it wasn't hazing, but it was like a high school prank. 10 football players at the tiny town of Byron. Have you been to Byron?
Byron, Illinois.
Yeah, Byron, Illinois. It's a cute little quaint town. But 10 of the football players, they were just being a little goofy. They went to the local store and purchased some Oreo cookies. Then thought it would be cool to put the Oreo cookie in between their buttocks. And, oh, gross.
Oh.
And they decided to run naked across the football field, trying not to, of course, drop the cookie.
We're going streaky! We're going streaking through the quad and into the gymnasium. Come on, everybody!
Giving off more noxious fumes than the nuclear plant in Byron.
Well, according to the Rockford Register, the ten football players had to sit out three games, including the state championship, and they lost that game 24-20 to Monticello High School. But just think, if they hadn't done the cookie run last October, they would have been fine. So the paper reported the story after obtaining a letter that was sent to parents because the school found out about it, and somebody had to snitch and had to ruin all the fun. I mean, it wasn't hazing.
It's not where you put an Oreo cookie.
Well, maybe, you know, I don't know. I mean, a lot of schools get in trouble because a lot of football players, there's hazing in the football departments. Remember in Stevenson High School, they had the banana issue where the freshmen were
hazed
by upperclassmen, and they stuck a banana in places where they shouldn't have stuck a banana. And people got suspended for that.
Like your ear?
No, yeah. Well, yeah, and then they wouldn't have been suspended. But these kids were just having fun. I just think, you know, let them be kids.
Where'd they put the milk?
Thank you. They were suspended for, quote unquote, indecent exposure.
Right in the butt. That was great.
I think they should be commended for their ingenuity, for not hazing. They're like, hey, let's see who can run 100 yards with an Oreo cookie in their butt.
And their tight buttocks, is right?
I mean that's got to be hard because you got to squeeze it in. You know, it's like putting a dime in between your butt. Okay, this sounds really gross.
No, tell me.
And then you try to run 100 yards. I mean, it's almost impossible not to drop the cookie. Do you guys want to try that here? We can have like team building.
I've heard like you could bounce a quarter off the buttocks, like right. You know, tight buttocks, like a good fastball, high and tight.
Right.
But no, not the cookie thing. Although I'm thinking about it,
I think it's hysterical.
I mean, I think I got the goods.
You think you could?
Yeah, I think I could.
Oreo cookie's pretty thick. I mean, did they get the double stuff, or was this a regular Oreo?
That's a good question.
Ew.
Come on. What is wrong with you? Grief. This is what happens when you work with kids.
Oh.
Scatological humor. Both of you, grow up. You're embarrassing me.
Okay.
So are they going to be back next year?
I don't know if they're juniors or seniors, but they did not file a complaint against their suspension. They took it like men and missed the state championship.
Yeah, took it right.
Can you imagine telling
right in
the
old backside?
Telling your son, yeah, we went to the state playoffs, but I wasn't in it. Why, Dad? Well, I was suspended for running naked across a football field with an Oreo cookie in my buttocks.
Yeah, and you know what his son's going to say? That's so awesome. I love you, Dad.
So kudos to the kids in Byron, Illinois. We are continuing our campaign to feed those less fortunate this holiday
nice
season.
Nice segue.
Thank you. Our goal is to provide food for a year and water for life.
No
for
Oreo cookies.
3,000 children in Haiti. One-time donation, guess what you get with that? You get to communicate with your child that you sponsor. Just kidding. You get to supply food for a year and clean water for life. $80 donation. If you think, I could just give $50, that's fine. Whatever you can give, we will gladly accept your donations. 844-862-HOPE. That's 844-862-4673. Or simply go to 560theanswer.com/food. And you can make your donation that way.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Let freedom ring this afternoon at 2 with Sean Hannity. Right before Joe Walsh at 5 on AM 560, The Answer.
Hey, the fresh fish experts at Bonefish Grill want to satisfy your weekend cravings with a new brunch menu. Featuring favorites like Bang Bang Shrimp Eggs Benedict and new dishes including Crab Cake Rancheros and Seasoned Avocado Toast. So visit BonefishGrill.com for the full menu or stop by your local restaurant today. And right now, you have a chance to win a $50 gift card to Bonefish Grill. Go to 560theanswer.com/bonefish. That's 560theanswer.com/bonefish. And good luck.
Again, the George H.W. Bush funeral service will be broadcast on these airwaves at 10 a.m. Starting at 10 a.m., we're going to take the funeral service live. So pencil that in if you want to hear the service. And I don't know. I assume there are going to be more memorable moments. It's going to be tough to beat, though, the moment of Senator Bob Dole rising from his wheelchair at the age of 95 to salute a fellow World War II hero and patriot, as he did with H.W.'s casket. I mean, that's just an indelible picture.
Yes, and you have to explain to your kids or grandkids what these two men represent. I mean, this is the last president that will ever be a World War II veteran, and a combat pilot. I mean, he flew 52 missions. On one of his last missions, two others in his aircraft died. He survived. He was rescued. It's just so heroic what he did and what he accomplished as a man. And after that, his dedication to the communities, whether he lived in Texas or, you know, he's representing the United States, he was a decent man and a family man. And today, his son, the president, George W. Bush, will be delivering the eulogy.
Quinn Hillier had a good piece remarking on the relationship and the evolution of that relationship between Dole and Bush 41. Dole, not a fortunate son, not a son of privilege, H.W. clearly was, but their paths intersected with service to our country, heroic service. And then in politics, you know, they squared off against one another in the 1988 primary to be the Republican nominee for president. They were not particularly close, but that changed when George H.W. Bush became president. George H.W. Bush. Dole, as the Republican Senate leader, worked unceasingly to promote Bush's agenda, Hillier correctly recalls. No senator could possibly have been more loyal and perhaps not so effective in that political climate. He also made mention of the fact that Dole supported Bush's son Jeb in 2016
yep.
in the presidential primary. And Dole remarked in the 2016 commemoration of Pearl Harbor's 75th anniversary, "This is a case where two political enemies became fast, fast friends, and that's the way it was supposed to be." Dole talking about Bush. So really interesting. And yeah, it's hard not to remark upon the World War II generation when you have a memorial to President Bush and then Bob Dole there as well. It's just sort of just a transcendental moment seeing him salute George H.W. Bush's casket.
It was historical, that's for sure. And right now we're awaiting the start of the Capitol departure ceremony. And then people from all over the world, Angela Merkel is coming in. Prince Charles is coming in. He made friends all in different countries, and they're coming to pay their respects to George H.W. Bush, the 41st president.
Again, as we've spoken about, including earlier this hour with Carthage College professor Art Sear, Bush gets high marks for managing the end of the Cold War, for repelling Saddam Hussein's invasion of Iraq. But then the domestic front is a different story, and frankly, it was pretty clear that Bush 41 was more motivated by foreign policy matters than domestic ones, breaking the no new taxes, read my lips, no new taxes pledge. It was interesting just to have the two Buckleys remark upon Bush 41. William F., the godfather of modern conservatism, Christopher, who was William F.'s son, who was a Bush speechwriter when Bush was vice president, Buckley said of George H.W. Bush, "He is conservative, but he's not a conservative." And I think that's an important statement, because we see that a lot, the contradiction, the paradox between how somebody lives their life and sometimes a philosophy they promote that's inconsistent with it. This is what Charles Murray has remarked upon with respect to what I call the champagne socialists. They don't believe in theory what they do in practice. They don't preach what they practice. And there was a little bit of that with H.W. Bush. I think Buckley's got good insight there, as he usually does. But I just have to go back to this Christopher Buckley remembrance of Bush 41 and addressing this issue that we talked about a little bit yesterday, but it bears repeating because the media is a culpable party here, the D.C. press corps, and it reminds you who they've always been, who they've always been. In the Trump era, it's a matter of degree, not kind. It's important. And how they try to characterize this World War II hero as a wimp. The Newsweek cover story about the wimp factor. And Christopher Buckley writes in this most excellent piece at The Spectator, "Mr. Bush's critics were constantly yapping at him for being preppy. As the 88 presidential campaign got underway, the war hero had been shot down while flying his torpedo bomber into a maelstrom of Japanese flak, found himself on the cover of Newsweek, ridiculed for what he called, what it called his wimp factor. I never once heard Mr. Bush chafe at the preposterous notion that he lacked walnuts. He was serene about his manhood, and why shouldn't he have been? If you had been to war as an 18-year-old pilot and seen death face to face, if you cradled your dying 4-year-old daughter in your arms, drilled for oil in Texas, raised a family, been elected to Congress, head of the Republican Party during Watergate, opened the first U.S. liaison office in China, run the CIA, got yourself elected VP of the United States, maybe you didn't need to have your manhood validated by smart-ass magazine editors and the soft-faced thumbsuckers of the punditariat." Christopher Buckley definitely had his father's rhetorical flair. But that's, it's interesting to remark upon the man and then assess his fateful one term as president, both domestically and from a foreign policy perspective. And, to do so soberly, even as you want to honor his service to the country.
One object that people are keeping their eyes on is a dog named Sully, the departed president's Labrador retriever that, he's captivated, political observers for the last few days, as we mourn the ex-president's passing, because that picture, I cannot get out of my mind of him laying down in front of his casket before he was transported to Washington, D.C. Via Air Force One. Sully went with on that flight. Sully was there yesterday, sitting by his casket, then laying down next to his casket once again. And, it wasn't his lifelong companion, but President Bush received Sully 6 months ago, right after his wife died. The family thought it would be good if he had a companion. And I honestly believe that Sully kept him alive a lot longer than he would have, because couples that are together for 73 years, even 60 plus years, they die soon within each other, especially if they're up in age at 94. And he loved that dog. He took that dog to go and vote. He took the dog out on walks every morning. He'd be in the wheelchair and the dog would be with him. So I don't think Sully's going to be at the mass today, but he's going back to Texas with him.
Yeah, I mean, Jeb Bush said it, just talking about this is a celebration of his life. I mean, look, President Bush had been in failing health for a long time. And his family knew it. They had prepared for this day. He had prepared for this day. James Baker even made reference to that in his final moments with HW. So I think that it's great to see the family take the proper posture to celebrate his life.
One of the aides who assisted him physically said, "Mr. President, Secretary Baker's here." And he opened both eyes. He looked at me. He said, "Hey, Bake, where are we going today?" And I said, "Well, Heffy," I said, "we're going to heaven." He said, "Good, that's where I want to go." Little did I know, or did he know, of course, that by 10 o'clock that night, he'd be in heaven.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Dan and Amy, the holidays, and may want to head down to Springfield, see the nativity scene, the holiday decorations, and the rotunda of the state capitol.
Has our newly elected governor been to Springfield yet?
Not keeping track of him.
How could you miss him?
Nativity scene for Christmas at the rotunda, capitol, sure. Menorah for Hanukkah. And then there's an arm holding an apple with a snake coiled around it.
Excuse me?
It's a gift from the Chicago branch of the Satanic Temple called Snaketivity. And it also has a sign that reads, "Knowledge is the greatest gift." From the Satanic Temple of Chicago's, isn't that where you attend service?
Hey, stop it.
Satanic Temple of Chicago, their GoFundMe page, will no longer allow one religious perspective to dominate the discourse in the Illinois State Capitol. Finally, please consider what you may do to help us bring Satan to Springfield. I mean, I hate to take the easy ones, but and I hate to break it to the Satanic Temple of Chicago, but in terms of bringing Satan to Springfield, somebody has beaten up to the punch.
Oh, I see.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You know, we talked about banning songs, certain songs we can't sing. Maybe It's Cold Outside.
Yeah, it's gone.
There's another song. The Princeton a cappella group can no longer sing Little Mermaids. Ready? I Kiss the Girl.
Sha-la-la-la-la-la, by your mind. Look like a boy too shy, ain't gonna kiss the girl.
It's the latest casualty of the social standards in this Me Too era.
Is that a holiday tune?
Well, no. It's Kiss the Girl. It's been dropped indefinitely because it's misogynistic and dismissive of consent. It's a play. It's Little Mermaids. It's like a Kiss the Girl. And then all the sisters are... Have you seen Little Mermaids? Probably not.
No.
You'd look very strange in a theater with your imaginary children seeing Little Mermaids.
Gay!
Yeah. Thanks for.
I don't think we can play this.
Can you turn that off now?
I'm trying. Hold on. There, it's off.
I'm with the PC crowd on that score. Just not for political reasons, just for musical reasons.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Speaking of hope, we're hoping that you help us get us past the finish line in our annual campaign to help those less fortunate this holiday season. Our goal, you know what it is.
Satanism may be all courant in Springfield, but Christianity and serving, being a servant leader, serving one's fellow man is what we do here, and that's what we're doing with Food for the Poor this year. 3,000 children in Haiti need food next year, need water for life, and that's what we aim to provide this holiday season.
Yeah, one-time donation of $80, and then that's what will happen. You'll feed a child for a year and provide clean water for life. Call this number, 844-862-HOPE. That's 844-862-4673, or just go to 560theanswer.com/food. Make a donation. It takes only a few minutes, I know, because I did it yesterday, and
We hope that you can do it today. Make a donation, too, on behalf of a well-fed child or grandchild, because so many kids receive toys that they, you know, next 6 months from now, they're going to not be interested in any way. So give a gift on behalf of one of your loved ones. Again, $80 is what we're asking for. If you can only give 50 or feel like giving 40, that's fine, too. Just call that number, 844-862-HOPE.
Timing of this is a bit serendipitous. President Bush did so much to raise money for the victims of the earthquake in Haiti in 2010. One of the things he did post-presidency was use his position to raise a lot of money for good causes to help other people. And that's what we're trying to do as well as we memorialize President Bush today. We've got another way to help in addition to the individual donation. We got the Business Benefactor Program. And we've had a number of businesses already sign up. Signature Bank, Palatine Complete Dental, AmericanEagle.com, Cafe Salsa, Spiegel and Cahill, Attorneys at Law. And the way you enroll in this program, make a $2,500 tax-deductible donation to Food for the Poor. And as a thank you from us, you get 60-second commercials for your business to promote it here on our airwaves, primetime broadcast hours, Monday to Friday, 5 a.m. to 8 p.m. windows. And the way to enroll, call our sales manager, Ann Jeanette, 847-472-8951. Again, 847-472-8951, and Ann Jeanette will take care of you.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.